Argument is Luster versus Illinois Department of Corrections. Mr. Cooper.
Good morning, Christopher Cooper, on behalf of plaintiff appellant Luster. The Illinois Department of Corrections provided an explanation of why it fired Mr. Luster.
Stay at the microphone or you won't be recorded.
That is unworthy of credence. So the IDOC claims that it had a good reason, a reason with a factual basis, to fire Lieutenant Luster. Mr. Luster showed the district court with indirect evidence that the real reason he was fired is because he's black. Mr. Luster simply had to show the district court an inference.
Are there other black corrections officers at Joliet?
There certainly are. But, Your Honor, Mr. Luster simply had to show an inference. Jackson versus E.G. Bratch doesn't say you need five inferences. I'm going to tell you about five inferences. You have to show an inference. That could be one inference. That the real reason that he was fired is because he is black. There are five inferences which can also be described as circumstantial evidence that Mr. Luster was fired because he is black. The first, Investigator Sims admits he doesn't even know if Mr. Luster was on duty on the day that Officer Cole claims that a black man gave her a hickey. The investigator admits, and the district court is well aware of this, that he doesn't even know if Lieutenant Luster was on duty. The investigator admits that he never did a sufficient investigation to determine if it was even possible for Officer Cole to be battered based on the layout of the room. Deputy Warden Harris testified, and the district court is well aware, that she's very suspicious, or was very suspicious, of Officer Cole's allegations, specifically based on the timing. Investigator Sims also expressed that he didn't believe at least one of the witnesses.
It wasn't Sims' call, ultimately, was it?
No, it was not. Okay. But Sims was a major player in this investigation. I want to say again, my understanding of Jackson versus E.G. Bratch at page 983 is that Mr. Luster simply needed to provide an inference. Nothing more. Mr. Luster had already satisfied McDonnell Douglas. Officer Kinsella is that similarly situated officer. And there's much more. The district court failed to consider everything. In Thadensen versus Board of Education, This court recognized that a fact by itself may not be enough. But if we consider all of them together, in the aggregate, Mr. Luster deserves a trial. There are too many issues in dispute. The real problem here, no employer in the 21st century is going to call a Mr. Luster type individual into an office and say, Mr. Luster, you're black and you've been accused of giving a hickey to a white female. And because you're black and because she's white, we're going to fire you. He was a correctional officer for almost 18 years. And the district court has this idealistic notion that employers are going to give the real reason. We have to consider the inferences. We have to consider the circumstantial evidence.
Mr. Cooper, I suspect that this veteran district judge has seen a lot of employment discrimination cases and is fully familiar with the phenomenon you're talking about.
Yes, Your Honor.
The problem that you're facing is the difference between the McDonnell-Douglas prima facie test, which the district court found you'd satisfied with respect to one comparator, and then the further step of having to show pretext in a case in which, as all too often happens, an employer is faced with conflicting evidence about grounds for discipline and even termination of an employee and has to make a decision. The concern here is that the test that you're proposing certainly seems pretty close to having a trial about whether the employer was right about whom to believe rather than a trial about whether race was the motivation in the decision. Is there any comfort you can give me on that problem?
The answer is both. The answer is both.
Both what?
Mm-hmm. There is an issue as to where, let me correct myself, Your Honor. My argument, perhaps, is asking this court to...
Well, in your brief, you were quite explicit about suggesting that we, in essence, stray from the McDonnell-Douglas pretext requirement.
Well, not
that's
stray.
That's not something we made up.
No, Your Honor, I understand that, and that was not my intent. My intent was to look at the Seventh Circuit's interpretation of McDonnell-Douglas, look at the Seventh Circuit's interpretation of how we arrive at pretext. And what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the circumstantial evidence of racial discrimination that I've referred to, and I've also referred to those as inferences, are enough to get Mr. Luster to...
Well, okay, but what do you have other than the fact that Luster says that Cole was lying and that the employer decided to believe Cole, who had a couple of people corroborating her story?
The five phenomena I just referred to, Your Honor, those five phenomena. In other words, Your Honor, these five things show that...
Maybe I lost count of them. Can you remind me what those five things are?
Your Honor, there are five of them. First of them, Investigator Sim says he doesn't even know if Lieutenant Luster was there.
Okay.
Right. Two, he
That's the layout of the room. Harris is suspicious about the timing.
Right.
Sims didn't believe one witness. What am I leaving out?
Is that...
Maybe I missed something.
I don't know. I was trying to follow
up. But that's the list that you gave us.
That's the list. And, there's a ref... I was not Mr. Luster's attorney at the time the case was in the district court. And there was reference to what Diane Tucker allegedly said to...
That's obviously hearsay, right?
Yeah, so I'm not even going to deal with that.
Okay.
But I want to go back to your original point. I understand that pretext should be considered perhaps some, and I'm using the word perhaps, and I'm going to use the word some, perhaps somewhat independent of McDonnell Douglas. Right. I'm suggesting that maybe we should try to look at both McDonnell Douglas and pretext in some way so that it all makes sense. Because right now we have a situation where he's able to show McDonnell Douglas, show satisfaction.
Can we be a little more precise here? Because McDonnell Douglas includes both the prima facie test and the pretext requirement, okay?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think the district, I agree. And I don't think the district court looked at things that way. I think the district court, based on my reading of the opinion, did it, a McDonnell Douglas analysis. And then, at that point, if you read the court's opinion, it looks like Mr. Luster's winning. It looks like he's going to score a touchdown.
You got the prima facie case.
But then, the district court says, well, the IDOC's reason seems credible. So the district court judge decided, without really explaining how the district court arrived at that position, well, it seems reasonable, so Mr. Lester doesn't get a trial. Why not the other way? And nothing further at this time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Mr. Siegel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the Court. There are two independent bases for this Court to affirm the District Court. One is the prima facie case, the failure to make that. The second is pretext. And if the Court has no objections, I'm going to move right into pretext. Counsel just mentioned five different items that are in dispute, he claims. None of them are material issues of disputed fact. And five times zero is zero. None of these issues shows pretext. There's no ability for the court to infer pretext. With respect to Sims's failure to look at the logs, the timing of when the incident occurred, Mr. Luster has conceded that he was, in fact, in Dwight on June 1st, the date of the incident involving the fondling and sucking on Cole's neck. And Mr. Sims said in his deposition, I really didn't consider this important. And it wasn't, because there's other evidence of his presence. Second, the position of the room. Again, Sims said in his deposition, I didn't consider it material. There were two witnesses that this actually occurred, that there was this attack by Luster on Cole. The third, I think, was Harris being suspicious. Sims saying that he didn't believe that he found something suspicious about one of the witnesses. I'm not sure which one a counsel was referring to. There is something about the timing of when Cole reported the incident, but in the context, this was an accretion of sexual abuse and harassment. There were phone calls, alleged phone calls at home to Cole's home. There were sexual suggestions and innuendos. There was the incident in the control panel, which is at the center of the case. And then on June 6th, somewhat later, Ms. Cole said in her complaint and in her deposition that she passed by Luster and he grabbed her buttocks. Her complaint, her grievance, was filed 2 days later on June 8th. And she was reprimanded for not reporting a major incident in a timely fashion. And I think that counsel has suggested that the fifth item is this idea that Assistant Warden Harris has provided a declaration that indicts the Dwight workplace as having institutional racism, or that the department is tinged with racism. There's nothing of that sort in that declaration. Even under the most creative read, Assistant Warden Harris's declaration never mentions institutional racism. It never declares that she was the victim of it or anyone else, and it barely even mentions race. It doesn't say that Dwight disciplines whites more leniently than African Americans, and it doesn't say, critically, that Assistant Warden Sigler Quigley herself, who was the ultimate decision maker, as you pointed out, Judge Hamilton, was in any way biased against African Americans. So if there was any problem with the investigation, and we submit there was not, it was ultimately the warden's decision as the chief administrative officer to recommend a suspension pending discharge here. Of course, there's absolutely no validity to the argument that this court should abandon the longstanding McDonnell-Douglas test, and Mr. Luster has not satisfied either of the critical prongs. It doesn't matter if the employment decision, as this court has pointed out in numerous cases, is wrong or immoral or mistaken. All that matters is that the employer have a good faith basis for making that decision and that it believe its decision. Here, there was a thorough investigation. That led to a hearing within the prison, which led to the warden making a recommendation. The warden, there's no evidence in the record that the warden suggested that Mr. Luster be terminated for any other reason than his actions in the control panel, his failure to help out with the investigation, his conduct. There's also not a shred of evidence in the record that there's some racial element to this at all. We've talked about Harris's declaration, which contains not an iota of this inference. Also, the statements, the hearsay statements by Davidson and Tucker, there's no racial element to either one of them. Mr. Luster has conceded in his brief that his case would be stronger if there was some context for Davidson's statement that hearing officer M already had her mind made up. That statement is subject to multiple interpretations. It's pure speculation and conjecture that there's any element of racism in that statement. But this court need not ever reach the issue of pretext if there's no prima facie case. And neither Kinsella nor Kozlowski were apt comparators. Mr. Kinsella, there's evidence in the record that Mr. Kinsella was recommended for discharge because of his sexual acts, his inappropriate touching of a colleague. Mr. Kozlowski, just like Luster, and I misspoke. There's no evidence in the record that the ultimate punishment for Mr. Kinsella was due to a sexual nature. There was insufficient evidence of that. He was accused of socializing with an inmate, giving a phone number, perhaps. And this court's decision in Sullivan versus Conway holds that it's testimony that takes precedence over an affidavit. It's Mr. Luster's admission in his deposition that Kinsella was not an apt comparator that takes precedence over the prior interrogatory.
That wasn't quite the way he said it, was it?
That wasn't.
Okay.
That's the result. What he said was
I understand, but I thought your position, though, about Kinsella, which the district court treated as an appropriate comparator, was simply that there was no evidence that the plaintiff had personal knowledge of the relevant facts.
That is our position. That is our position. Mm-hmm. The district court reached the incorrect decision about whether Kinsella was an apt comparator. Of course, the warden who makes the recommendation, whose affidavit is in the record, has direct knowledge of what the personnel decisions is. But we made a second point as well. There's conflict between Mr. Luster's interrogatory and his deposition testimony. Mr. Luster cannot create a disputed issue of material fact by saying one thing and then saying another. It's his deposition testimony that governs. So, given the absence of a prima facie case,
is that always the case? Because ordinarily, for example, when we ask, when a lawyer asks for interrogatory answers, the party is required to provide all information available to that party, whether that party has personal knowledge or not, whether it's information that the lawyers discovered through their investigation. It's a very difficult comparison. It's not the affidavit versus deposition kind of comparison that comes up all the time. But interrogatories play a very different role, don't they?
No doubt. The analogy might not be the tightest fit, but the underlying principle in the Sullivan case is that the unguarded statement in the deposition that is not written out by an attorney governs, takes precedence over something that conflicts.
Well, that's not a very satisfactory solution, frankly, because I thought the problem would have to be simply that the plaintiff is not able to use his own interrogatory answers as evidence. They can summarize admissible evidence, but they're not evidence themselves. You can use them against him, just as he can use your interrogatory answers against you.
And again, there's a second that may well be, but the alternative basis for finding that Kinsella is not an apt comparator is that it was well within the warden's personal knowledge, mm-hmm. what the disciplinary decision is. But of course, if this court decides that there was no prima facie case, that doesn't matter, because what's dispositive here is that there was no pretext. And we would ask that the court affirm the district court on either of those grounds. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Siegel. Mr. Cooper, your time has expired, but you can have a minute if you have.
I'm not. I realize this court can't change what McDonnell Douglas stands for. I'm aware of that. However, this court can certainly interpret the facts in this case and interpret McDonnell Douglas and interpret the relevant cases as to pretext, Johnson v. Nordstrom, Guerrero, Jackson. All Mr. Luster had to do, and he did it, was to show an inference. And once again,
Mr. Cooper, could I just ask you to address this problem I was just asking about, namely, what admissible evidence is there that Kinsella was an appropriate comparator here? Admissible evidence.
Your Honor, I have to admit that, again, I wasn't the attorney at the time, and the attorney should have pushed IDOC to provide more information. All that I can say to you is this. Lieutenant Luster has a reasonable belief that Officer Kinsella made a phone call to an offender and had sexual intercourse.
But he doesn't have firsthand knowledge.
No, he does not. He does not. And had I been his counsel at the time, I would have pushed IDOC for that additional information. But I don't think that this case should fall apart for that reason. I think the real issue is that Mr. Luster showed pretext. Mr. Luster was required to show pretext with indirect evidence. I believe that Mr. Luster did that, and that's why I mentioned those five phenomena. And once again, I'm concerned.
Okay, but your time has expired, Mr.
Thank you.
Cooper. So thank both counsel for their efforts. Next.